I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for Three Stories You Should Know. This week, we're going to talk about marijuana. My guests are Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports via Skype and Cindy Bourne of The Washington Post. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, nice to be here.
We're talking about marijuana. Vice Sports has to be represented.
Cindy, you get to kick this one off.
Patrick and I will play the roles of Harold and Kumar today. This is actually a very serious topic, and I don't mean to treat it in any other way. You know, the NFL is now facing an issue, a crisis, really, of opioid abuse that's frankly not really any different than ordinary America. Players are playing a game that is incredibly painful, so they're looking for anything. And, you know, the NFL over the years has pushed prescription drugs, Toradol, for instance, and these have long-range effects that really wreak havoc on the system. And players are turning increasingly to marijuana. And this is a new science, but it's being shown to have an effect on alleviating pain. And you're seeing people like Stephen Jones and Jerry Jones from the Dallas Cowboys coming out and saying, you know, it's time the NFL looks at this marijuana ban. Now, Roger Goodell's on the other side of the fence. He's still sort of taking the stance that it's addictive, more study needs to be done. And we'll see. I mean, clearly it would have to be negotiated into the collective bargaining agreement. But if you care about the people, then you're going to want what would be the safest way for them to seek pain relief.
It's an issue not just in the NFL. It's kind of across sports, and really it's across society. Up until the 40s, it was in the U.S. pharmacopoeia. And when it went into these drug laws, we went into sort of the reefer madness era, American doctors were saying, don't do this. Don't put this on the schedule. But of course it did for other reasons. And that's a different podcast and a different radio show. But I mean, basically the sports leagues are sort of reacting and are sort of behind the times, just as society is. And I think with someone like Roger Goodell, I don't know what he really believes, but I think the leagues are just sort of hesitant to make full on moves until they see all of society and not just certain states in the U.S. making a full-on move.
You know, he's not going to want to give any ground on this with the players without getting something in return. I mean, this is a negotiation, and it will be a couple of years down the line, most likely. But, you know, that's not too far off.
Well, that's disgusting. I mean, if we're talking about a negotiation involving people's health, I find that deplorable. But do you think ultimately we're going to reach a point where players are recognized as the best sources of what they should do in order to alleviate their pain?
Yeah, I think so. And I think especially when you've got the Drug Enforcement Administration looking into the NFL doctors and how they prescribe drugs, you're seeing these guys, you know, our heroes, when they retire, they're limping around, they're in pain, they die. And I think when you look at the idea that there's something safer available, I think people are becoming more and more receptive.
But in the meantime, I think they'd be very smart to at least adopt a don't ask, don't tell policy, where stop testing for this, stop suspending people for it, just don't do anything.
Okay, I want to talk a little about baseball statistics. The measurement of a player's value has come a long way in my long lifetime. We used to just be able to talk about wins and earned run average when we talked about pitchers. Batting average, runs batted in, and home runs, that was enough to evaluate a hitter. This week, I read an article by Adam Willis for Slate, and it suggests that the next leap forward might be a way to measure team chemistry, and more specifically, to assign a number value to the extent to which a player makes his teammates better. And I think I hate this idea. It's too new for me to be completely sure. But some matters, it seems to me, should remain subjective, even in a game so thoroughly drenched in statistics as baseball is. Cindy, you go along with this, or do you like the idea of science measuring how well a player makes his teammates better?
I'm with you on this, Bill. I'm just not sure it's possible. It's not high school chemistry. It's team chemistry. And, you know, who knows what makes for good chemistry? Hmm. You can take the most volatile people and you can have the most successful team imaginable. And you can have a team like, for instance, the Nationals here in Washington, who were clicking and doing everything really well. And then they bring in a guy like Jonathan Papelbon and it just completely upsets the clubhouse.
I could have told him that would happen.
Did you have an algorithm for that? Have you been examining?
No, I just watched the Red Sox.
See, exactly. You don't need an algorithm for it.
Patrick, what about you? You ready to stand up for science?
No, well, here's my thing. I am ready to stand up for science, and this is does not sound scientific at all. That's the problem with it. I'd like to hear a lot more about what are you actually trying to quantify? What are you actually measuring? They call economics the dismal science, right? The reason they call it that is because ultimately it is the study of human behavior and psychology, and humans are infinitely unpredictable and difficult when it comes to our behavior to figure out what we're going to do tomorrow.
You know, two things occur to me on this. One is what fun it would be to be a fly on the wall when an agent comes into negotiations and says, look at these stats that show that my guy is going to make your whole team so much better just by being a terrific influence in the clubhouse. I can't wait to hear the response to that. The other thing that I'm thinking of is an old friend of mine who passed on some years ago named Lenny Marullo. He was a longtime baseball scout, and he used to tell me that he could tell how good a player was by watching him get off the bus. And I kind of like that, you know? I kind of like that. Oh, yeah, I know what this kid's going to be. I don't have to see him do anything but get off the bus.
I thought we lived through Moneyball to get away from that. Are we full circle? Time really is a flat circle. Jesus.
All right, Patrick, I understand that you have some good news for us, and we're certainly ready for that.
I do. My story involves FIBA, and that's not the international soccer organization that exists for extravagant bribes and also the World Cup. That's FIFA. I'm talking about FIBA, which is basketball's international governing body. This week, they announced as of October, they're no longer going to ban players from wearing religious head coverings on the court. It's a pretty significant move because before this, players with strong religious beliefs didn't have any options. You know, we had a story on this at Vice Sports. We profiled a former University of Memphis women's basketball player who wanted to play pro in Europe. Because she's Muslim, she wanted to wear a hijab, and she couldn't do it. But when you look at the change, it does raise a question, which is, why was this even a rule in the first place? FIBA says this was a, quote, safety precaution. But there's no actual evidence that any player was ever hurt during a game because of headgear. It still took 2 years for FIFA of having a trial period to make a decision here. I understand people are touchy about mixing politics, religion, sports. But this wasn't like somebody holding a calf with masks in the middle of a game. And it's not like some simple head cover is like wearing spiked pads in American football.
Got an impression helmet.
This is a very simple expression of faith. The only thing I can figure is that this took a while because of fear and prejudice. So I'm happy and I'm hopeful because I think some good come out of this. You know, when we talk about fear and prejudice and someone who might see religious headgear and feel threatened, what better way to realize this is actually safe and this is actually fine than seeing people play basketball in it?
I think that's an excellent point. Cindy, you have anything good to say about FIBA?
I do, actually. And I don't know why, but there seems to be a general movement of Muslim women toward working out and toward sports competition. I've profiled a couple of times a young girl, 17-year-old girl from Minnesota named Amaya Zafar, who fell in love with boxing. And she has tried and tried and tried to get bouts and has not been able to. Because until recently, the U.S. Boxing Association said you couldn't, you know, part of hijab isn't just the headgear, it's having your whole body covered, and the rules specify that refs have to be able to see if you've had injuries to your body. USA Boxing is now saying, you know what, I think in another couple of months, we're just going to take that off the books. It's just silly. But, you know, you have, you saw in the London Olympics, and again in the Rio Olympics, a number of women who were competing while wearing hijab, including a fencer from the U.S. who ended up winning a medal. You have Nike now launching its pro hijab line because, of course, there's a buck to be made there.
Right, of course. That's what you know, it's true progress.
Frankly, you know, you do. And you have women who are running marathons. It's just becoming less and less of a big deal. And Amaya Zafar was telling me, I'm devout, my religion is important to me, but so are sports, and I should be able to have both of those.
Again, if it's not giving someone an advantage and it's not hurting anybody, it seems totally harmless. And it seems like, what would you rather have? These stupid rules? Or would you have rather more people competing in sports? And I think the answer is pretty clear.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports and Cindy Boren of The Washington Post. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thanks, Bill.
Always a pleasure, Bill.